This podcast of Bookworm is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm honored to have as my guest Joan Didion. We are going to talk about her book, The Year of Magical Thinking. Of course, a terribly sad event was the provocation of the book, and her life has been dealing with other sad events about which I don't know how to speak, and will speak about the book itself. Now, you speak about, as a writer, that knowing what people would do is like breathing to you, and also that you've gone to a file called The Effect of the Change that you started to write, I guess, only days after John Gregory Dunn had died.
Right, it was called Notes on Change.
Yes.
I wasn't thinking about keeping a file. I was just making a note, You know, it's like a reflex for a writer to write things down because that's how you understand them. But this was something that happened that I didn't understand at all, you know.
It becomes the refrain in this book. You look at it again in May, and then I guess in October when you start to write the book. And the book, in a sense, becomes organized around
the
refrain.
Right. And the refrain was, let me find it. Life changes fast. Life changes in the instant. You sit down to dinner and life as you know it ends. The question of self-pity. The whole book became an exploration of those disjointed words. There was a point at which, I mean, I didn't set out to write a book. In October, I had sort of tentatively gone back to work. I had done the chronology was John died on December 30th, 2003. And Quintana, our daughter, was in the hospital, and she was in the hospital until mid-July. And so once she was out of the hospital, I did a piece that I'd promised to do for the New York Review on the campaign. And then I sat down to just collect my notes from this kind of disastrous series of events that was pretty much filling my mind. I mean, it was certainly front and center. And when I started doing the notes, I realized after about 3 days that I was thinking about how to organize them, which wasn't my intention. I mean, my intention had been not to just type the notes for whatever reason. But if you're thinking how to organize them, you're thinking about writing a book. And it seemed to me that the only possible way to organize them was to keep repeating the same scenes. It was a way of replicating the exact experience. I mean, the experience of when something like this happens, you just keep obsessing on it. You see the same scene running over and over and over again, and you keep. Sometimes it has new details. Sometimes it has fewer details. So that was the general idea. Everything repeated itself.
Now, you talk about the famous sentence in your first article for Life magazine that announced that you were in Hawaii in lieu of filing for divorce, a kind of sentence that shook everyone who read it and I think shakes them still. You knew then that you would be living a life in public as a writer. That has been part of your subject.
Right.
And I wondered whether that has had a cost.
Well, I think any life led in public has a cost. I mean, it costs you something. On the other hand, it's certainly part of being a writer. Because you're living a life in public, whether or not you're ever seen in public. Your innermost thoughts are in public. They're out there. So that's what makes writing a kind of breathtakingly daring act for somebody who's essentially shy, which I was as a child.
It seems astonishing to me, but did you feel then, in a sense, that to write about this book, if you wrote at all, would be obligatory?
It was obligatory. It was obligatory on a whole series, for a whole series of reasons. One was it was the only way I was going to understand it and come to terms with what had happened, because that's just the way I work. I mean, that's the way my mind works. I don't actually register anything or think about it until I've written it down. The other thing was, it was obligatory to, since this was the thing that was on my mind, what was I going to do? It would be dishonest to sit down and write something else. At the time that John died, I had a contract to do a book about the Kobe Bryant case. Well, I wasn't going to go back to the Kobe Bryant case. That wasn't on my mind at all. I mean, at that point in my life, it would have been a very destructively dishonest thing to do, because it would have been just shutting out the reality of what had happened and not putting it out there. I mean, there's a sense in which any kind of writer, like any kind of actor, is about putting it out there on the line for the audience. It's a performance, and so you have to do that.
The show must go on.
It's like an aerialist. If you don't do it, you're going to get scared and never do it again.
Wow. I wondered to what extent you were aware. I'm sure that you were using, to write this book, every bit of craft at your disposal, because it's what, like an aerialist, you had to rely on. But it struck me while reading it that it was bringing aspects of your writing together, perhaps for the first time, that there's the Joan Didion who, in The Last Thing He Wanted, is reconstructing an event moment by moment in order to solve, to some extent, a criminal story, to figure out what happened during a vacant 3 minutes of time, very brief. And then there's the vortex kind of time that had appeared in Play It As It Lays and other books, time that ripples outward from a central moment so that you can barely see what you're trying to think about because of the string of associations. And seeing that specificity played against that rippling effect seemed truly astonishing to me.
I wasn't, I didn't even think I was writing this book. It was like, because my intention was just to make it artless, I didn't want that style, I didn't want it to get in, I didn't want it to get in the way of the directness of it. So I thought I wasn't writing it. And then I realized an excerpt of it was going to be published in a magazine, and the magazine, in the normal course of things, copy edited it. And then when I saw the copy edit, I realized, and I had to naturally take the copy editing out and restore it to the way I had written it. But it was the first time I realized that, in fact, I had written the book, that there was quite a lot of craft in it, although I hadn't planned it. I mean, the craft was devoted, I guess you can devote craft just as arduously to making something look artless as you can as you can to to making it look grafted.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning of the book that you wanted none of the impenetrability that had come to characterize your later work.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yes. What do you mean by impenetrability, though?
Well, I mean, if something is about to be revealed, then I generally, my instinct is to move away from it and not quite reveal it. This was a case in which I was going to reveal something over and over and over again until you couldn't look away from it. I mean, it was just a whole different experience. The writing of it was a different experience.
And in avoiding impenetrability, did you feel yourself developing new techniques?
Well, no, because I thought this was a kind of one-time technique. It was, for example, there are no transitions. It's like a stream of consciousness. Just thoughts, any thought that came to mind, I just put down, right? Now, quite often I took, if the thought was wrong or obtrusive at that point, I would take it out that night, you know, when I went over the pages. So it wasn't totally unedited or wasn't totally straight as it came out of my mind. But it certainly was to a greater degree than most things I write.
Do you feel, because there's so much in this book, so much more that stands revealed, and there's a place when you say that those people who used to ask John Gregory Dunn and I if we were competitive, there's something that they don't know about marriage.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, so much stands for so much more. You know, it's such an extraordinary compacting of a 40-year marriage, so that it stands not only in the literature of grief, but in the literature of marriage. And I wondered, that always seemed to me to be a very private thing.
Well, I hadn't intended to write about the marriage at all. I mean, I don't mean that I had decided not to. I just mean that it wasn't, I thought I was going to write something about grief. But in fact, I was going through grief as I was writing it. And one of the things that you do, that you have to do in the course of mourning, is you have to confront all of those memories which keep coming at you. And for the first 6 months certainly after John died, I had been unable to deal, to go through that, to face those things, because I couldn't afford to, because Quintana needed me. I mean, so all my adrenaline was going away, was going toward keeping totally away from any memory that might upset me. So at the point when I began writing the book, I realized that those things were coming back to mind, so I had to write them down.
I'm speaking with Joan Didion about her book, The Year of Magical Thinking. You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and we're recording in the studios of KCRW. The Year of Magical Thinking is published by Knopf. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Joan Didion about The Year of Magical Thinking, published by Knopf. Now, magical thinking, The first time I became aware of what you felt about it was in an article about South America, and you commented about magical realism, that you felt the political devastations in that continent had been so enormous that it was magical realism, a childlike response to a reality that could not be confronted. And I think you've never liked magical thinking.
Well, I mean, I certainly didn't dream that I would ever engage in it, but I certainly did.
What is it?
Well, I mean, as anthropologists use it, it's the belief that you can control events through certain rituals or invocations or actions which are entirely superstitious in nature. For example, if you make a sacrifice, you'll have crops will come in. In my case, I realized that I was engaging in it I just realized that I couldn't give away some of John's clothes because I thought he was going to need them. If I gave them away, he wouldn't come back. Then I realized that I was thinking he would come back. Well, that is that. I was thinking I could control events, which I couldn't. No one can. That was the big lesson.
Is writing an attempt of control of that sort?
Of course, writing is an attempt to control events. You can write yourself a pretty controlled little world.
Was it possible then to keep on writing?
Well, I had to. I mean, I didn't know any other way to organize the world. It's probably folly to think you can organize the world too. It's like imagining that you have control over it. But to the extent that I could come to terms with it at all, it was going to be through writing it down.
Because it has always seemed to me true that the women who I think of immediately when I think of your work have to somehow learn not to organize their lives. You know, that lesson that Mariah learns that nothing applies seems to be, you know, a defense against organization.
But they have to learn it over and over again. And I had never really learned it.
Knew it but not learned it?
Right.
When you discovered that you were writing a book, it does seem that this book has all kinds of abilities to order within it. Was that because it had become a literary project, and literary projects, if not life, can be organized?
I think that's right. If I could organize the book, I could perilously organize my life, right? Or I could impose that order. I could borrow that order for my life. It was very important to me. For example, the ending of the book, I couldn't get that right because the traditional ending for this kind of book is some kind of resolution, right? But I hadn't come to any kind of resolution. The situation, as far as I was concerned, was not resolved. And so the first time I finished it, the last, there was this kind of false resolution in the last 20 pages. And they were a mess, in fact. And then I set it aside for a couple of weeks after I had more or less finished it. I'd finished it with this false ending on the 31st of December that year, which had been my intention to do it all within the span of the year. But I put it aside for a few weeks and then rewrote it, and then found a way not to resolve it, but to somehow live with the lack of resolution. Which was useful to me.
This is Joan Didion reading from the concluding chapter of The Year of Magical Thinking.
I realize as I write this that I do not want to finish this account, nor did I want to finish the year. The craziness is receding, but no clarity is taking its place. I look for resolution and find none. I did not want to finish the year because I know that as the days pass, as January becomes February and February becomes summer, certain things will happen. My image of John at the instant of his death will become less immediate, less raw. It will become something that happened in another year. My sense of John himself, John alive, will become more remote, transmuted into whatever best serves my life without him. In fact, this is already beginning to happen. All year I've been keeping time by last year's calendar. What were we doing on this day last year? Where did we have dinner? Is it the day a year ago we flew to Honolulu after Quintana's wedding? Is it the day a year ago we flew back from Paris? Is it the day? I realize today for the first time that my memory of this day a year ago is a memory that does not involve John. This day a year ago was December 31, 2003. John did not see this day a year ago. John was dead. I was crossing Lexington Avenue when this occurred to me. I know why we try to keep the dead alive. We try to keep them alive in order to keep them with us. I also know that if we are to live ourselves, there comes a point at which we must relinquish the dead, let them go, keep them dead. Let them become the photograph on the table. Let them become the name on the trust accounts. Let go of them in the water. Knowing this does not make it any easier to let go of him in the water. In fact, the apprehension that our life together will decreasingly be the center of my everyday seemed today on Lexington Avenue so distinct a betrayal that I lost all sense of oncoming traffic. I think about leaving the lay at St. John the Divine, a souvenir of the Christmas in Honolulu when we filled the screen with blue. During the years when people still left Honolulu on the Matson lines, the custom at the moment of departure was to throw lays on the water, a promise that the traveler would return. The lays would get caught in the wake and go bruised and brown, the way the gardenias in the pool filter at the house in Brentwood Park had gone bruised and brown. The other morning when I woke, I tried to remember the arrangement of the rooms in the house in Brentwood Park. I imagined walking through the rooms, first on the ground floor and then the second. Later in the day, I realized that I had forgotten one. The lay I left at St. John the Divine would have gone brown by now. Lays go brown, tectonic plates shift, deep currents move, islands vanish, rooms get forgotten. I flew into Indonesia and Malaysia and Singapore with John in 1979 and 1980. Some of the islands that were there then would now be gone, just shallows. I think about swimming with him into the cave at Portuguese Bend, about the swell of clear water, the way it changed, the swiftness and power it gained as it narrowed through the rocks at the base of the point. The tide had to be just right. We had to be in the water at the very moment the tide was right. We could only have done this a half a dozen times at most during the 2 years we lived there, but it is what I remember. Each time we did it, I was afraid of missing the swell, hanging back, timing it wrong. John never was. You had to feel the swell change. You had to go with the change. He told me that. No eyes on the sparrow, but he did tell me that.
It's extraordinarily beautiful. It really is.
Thank you, Michael.
You say that his last present to you was saying, after he'd reread a section of a Book of Common Prayer, that you couldn't tell him anymore that you weren't a good writer.
Yeah, it was. I mean, he'd read it during a snowstorm. You know, we were stuck in having dinner at home, and we were sitting by the fire, and he read this passage out loud. It was just it was 3 weeks before he died.
I wondered, given that you're a very good writer, what does it take after you've lost the person who can tell you that you are for you to know that?
The first thing I wrote after John died was a piece for the New York Review on the campaign, and I found it very hard, even though I have an editor I trust more than, I mean, just trust implicitly at the New York Review. Robert Silvers is, I know he will not let me fall off the branch, right? But I still felt it was very hard to do without John. As the only other thing I've done since John died is this book, and I had a strong feeling that it would be okay. I mean, that he would think it was okay.
Has this told you, this experience with the Year of Magical Thinking, that you can write another book?
Yes, it probably has told me I can write another book, because I did it this time.
Do you want to?
Well, I suppose I will, yeah. I haven't. I don't know what it will be, but yes.
Because those of us who've in some way been given instruction in endurance from you by reading you, like me, need it.
Well, good.
I've been speaking with Joan Didion, author most recently of The Year of Magical Thinking, published by Knopf. Thank you, Joan, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can read an excerpt from The Year of Magical Thinking on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Days of old, when knights were bold, and books, 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 books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
You've been listening to KCRW's Bookworm. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Good Food, a weekly exploration of culinary trends, tantalizing recipes, and intriguing discoveries in food and drink. Check out the podcast of Good Food at kcrw.com.